Hi, this is Richard Rutkowski, cinematographer of Castle Rock, Jack Ryan, Manhattan, and other shows, and you're listening to the Go Creative Show.
Hey everyone, my name is Ben Consoli. I am a director and owner of BC Media Productions. This is the Go Creative Show, the show dedicated to creative professionals in the video production and filmmaking industries. Today we speak with Richard Rutkowski, the cinematographer for Hulu's Castle Rock. Richard and I discuss what inspired the series' look, the cameras and lenses used on Castle Rock, the most challenging scenes, and what you can expect from season two. Plus, his work on other shows like Jack Ryan and The Americans. The Go Creative Show is sponsored by Rule Boston Camera, Magnanimous Rentals, Shutterstock, Hedge.video, and PremiumBeat.com. Jack Ryan. The Americans, Castle Rock. I mean, let's face it, our guest today, Richard Rutkowski, is on a roll, and he does really, really fantastic work. And so this interview coming up, I am really excited to share, because all of those shows are great. I am such a huge fan of The Americans, and Castle Rock is excellent. It's just about to jump into its second season this month. So there's a lot going on around him and around his shows, and I'm so excited for you guys to hear this interview. And that's coming up in just a couple of minutes. Couple of things. A great way to get your voice heard on the Go Creative Show is by simply following us on social media, because when you do, we post when we have guests coming up. And a lot of the questions in our shows lately have been questions directly from you guys, our listeners. So it's a great way to sort of get a little shout out on the show, have your question heard, and the questions have been so good. You guys are excellent at asking questions, sometimes better than me. So I really have been relying on those questions quite a bit because you guys just nail it. And I knew you would. Of course you would. So continue following us on social media, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. We're all there at Go Creative Show. And check it out because we will post upcoming guests and you get a chance to have your question heard on the show. All right, let's take a quick minute and talk about Shutterstock.com. Now, Shutterstock, it's the place to go, obviously, for stock footage and photos. There's music there. There's all sorts of stuff there. I mean, they have over 14 million royalty-free video clips right now. Actually, 16 million. Wow, I'm looking at it right now. 16 million royalty-free video clips. I'm not even including the photos, just the videos. Many of them are in 4K. They add over 100 clips weekly. So you're going to find what you're looking for. The prices are always great. That's all there, and we've talked about that a bunch of times. Today, I want to highlight Shutterstock's blog, because I personally think it's an excellent source of inspiration for me and for all of you guys. I know you would love it over there. And we don't talk about it as much as we should. So if you go to shutterstock.com/blog, you're going to find a whole bunch of really great articles that personally, I have found very inspirational every time I go over there. And they just put out a new article right now that's great. It's all about the celebration of Day of the Dead with illustrator Naila Velasquez. And it's fantastic. They have a short video there. They have a post all about her inspiration, the color palettes that are associated with Day of the Dead. There's just so much going on there. And that's just one article. So next time you're sitting by your computer, you have maybe a little brain block when you're editing something, or you just need a change of pace, go to shutterstock.com/blog and see what they have to offer. I can pretty much guarantee you, you're going to find something that at least interests you, and you're going to be very surprised by how inspirational a lot of these stories can be. So it's all there at shutterstock.com/blog. All right. You guys ready? I know I am. Let's get right to it. Our interview with Richard Rutkowski, the director of photography for Castle Rock. So I'm here with Richard Rutkowski. He's the director of photography for Castle Rock and so much more. We're going to get into all of that coming up. Richard, thank you so much for being on the Go Creative Show.
It's my pleasure. Hello.
So you're shooting basically in my backyard, kind of. You're shooting in Massachusetts, Castle Rock, right now. My office is in Haverhill. You're like a half an hour away from me. What is it like shooting in Massachusetts?
Give me your address and we'll get right in your backyard. How does that sound?
Yeah, I like it. Well, there's a lot of good locations here in Haverhill. Actually, Nosferatu just shot something in Haverhill 2 weeks ago. They did an overnight shoot somewhere close by.
We shot in Haverhill briefly during episode 205. And we're slated to go back to Haverhill for a car stunt. the river that goes through there, I guess Merrimack, it's the Merrimack River, had some issues with recent rain, which prevented us doing a car stunt where a car will go in the water. Spoiler alert.
Wow.
In any case, we will return and put the car in the water. So I suggest you get a bathing suit and come on over.
Oh, I would love that.
I just don't know the date. That's still being sorted out. Is it my understanding that Haverhill is where Rob Zombie is from?
Yes, it is. Although the rumor is, and I have no idea for sure, but the rumor is that he doesn't really like Haverhill and doesn't like to talk about it. But I don't know that for sure.
Okay. In any case, yes, it's been nice shooting in Massachusetts. I shot season one of the show in Massachusetts. One big difference this season is that we're going from colder weather into warmer weather. The first season started in July of 2017 and definitely went from warmer weather into colder weather. We didn't finish until early January of 2018, the first season. So we started having the usual Massachusetts problems of unpredictable big snows and impassable roads or ice conditions and things like that. This summer has been going very well. I'm familiar with Massachusetts because of my background. I attended Harvard College in the 80s. And when I first got into making films and going out and trying to find a place on the cruise of films, it was in Massachusetts. I was living in Cambridge, Mass, and riding my motorcycle around with my AC kit bag strapped to the back and discovering Massachusetts the very direct way, which is driving to multiple sets. And you know, I love Massachusetts and I love Bostonians, and it's a pleasure to be back, but more so for me in a sentimental way. Many of the crew members we have, including my gaffer and Key Grip and Dolly Grip, are some of the very first crew members I ever met when I was like 22 years old.
Really?
And some of them worked with me on the film School Ties, big throwback, I'm that old. I was the second assistant on School Ties in the early 1990s. Which was a pretty big film for Massachusetts at that time.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I have a history in Massachusetts and enjoy being back. And the areas we go to are full of history and interesting, and that's why they're on film with us. And, you know, while we're trying to portray the show as taking place in central Maine, I'm not averse to exploiting what we have right in front of us to make the better work.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Stephen King is all over this series. I mean, it's when you watch the preview, it says from the mind of Stephen King. And I'd love to know how he was incorporated into the show, because I know Castle Rock isn't, it's not like an adaptation of a book that he wrote. It's kind of a mixture of all sorts of a whole bunch of his stories. Can you give us a little bit of insight into how Stephen King is involved in Castle Rock?
Well, it's all based on his previous output. I mean, it's all based on work he created in a number of books and using a number of characters that pre-exist this show. It's treated almost like an anthology, and that the King universe is being sourced for characters and plot lines and references. Castle Rock in particular is a central Maine town that he sets a number of stories in. And Castle Rock is always portrayed in a rather unfortunate, doomed and or haunted light, Stephen King. And this season, we're taking the extra liberty of placing Castle Rock very close to Jerusalem's Lot. So a lot of the stories that have been set around Jerusalem's Lot and Castle Rock are being interwoven, along with a new element created by our showrunner, Dustin Thomason, which is the existence of a thriving Somali community in Maine. And this is truth. There is a thriving Somali community.
Oh, yeah.
That is in Maine. And we are exploiting that for dramatic purposes and for purposes of like the situation in one town versus the situation in the other town, a tale of two cities.
How involved is Stephen King in the project? Like, other than, you know, adapting his stories into this, you know, one large story, is he involved? Like, is he on set? Did you meet him?
No, I never have. I certainly would tell you if I had. That would be a thrill. I don't know the degree to which he's involved, other than, of course, it's his complete library of books set in this central Maine area that are being sourced. Hmm.
Talk to me a little bit about the prep for season one and now season two of Castle Rock.
Well, in season one, you are always trying to create a show identity, and you're trying to find a stylistic and a visual architecture that is going to have legs for all sorts of different narrative material. And we seized on some ideas based on how haunted and how difficult the place was and how it was almost impossible for people to get out of it. You had a lead character played by Andre Holland, who was fantastic, and he's drawn back. He's drawn back to the place that he sought so badly to escape. You have a mysterious prisoner who may or may not be the embodiment of all sorts of other things, played by Bill Sarsgaard, who's literally trapped in a cage underneath the infamous Shawshank prison. And then you begin the show with the resolution by a warden of Shawshank to kill himself very dramatically right in the namesake Castle Lake. So you're setting up this idea that here is a place that while outwardly people should really try to avoid or get out of, they seem to keep being drawn back into it, and to what purpose and for what reason. And that led to a few different decisions in terms of desaturation, in terms of color palette, in terms of camera positioning and, you know, scene coverage. And I think those were enacted very successfully. The second season is seeking to sort of scaffold on the best parts of the first, but it is also equally importantly seeking to be its own story, because this is not a series in the traditional sense. Unlike Blue Bloods or something, you do not return to the first episode of season two and see the same characters in their similar situations that you had in season one. Instead, it's a whole new set of stories played by entirely different actors. So it's a total recasting and it's a reimagining of what the storyline is going to be throughout the season. In many respects, this season is a more exciting season, and a more it moves along at a pace and develops things rather quickly. In other respects, it's very much like last season in that if you're paying attention to it and following the theme of it, particularly, you're going to find a depth of meaning that isn't immediately in the activity of the characters. It emerges, and I think that's really brilliant.
Let's talk about the look of Castle Rock. You had mentioned a little bit earlier about this desaturation kind of look to it, tying into the Stephen King characters and the area that we're trying to portray here. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Well, we started shooting in the height of summer, and if you walk outdoors right now, it's full-on green, full-on New England green, verdant. It would be hard to portray this as depressing, and then it led into autumn, which is also typically a very gorgeous New England period of time, and here you are in this very beautiful place, and you're trying to express dread, you're trying to express hopelessness or a feeling of entrapment. So one of the ways we went about that was to pull a lot of the yellow and warm tones out and to work with desaturation. And to varying degrees, as you go into Shawshank Prison, as you go into the police station of Castle Rock, as you go into the woods, we were really pushing desaturation in daylight and for our characters. But then at night, we switched it up a little and we'd add colored gels to nighttime lighting, or we'd bring a very strong warmth to a firelight or something like that, or we'd allow the tungsten lamps on the outside of buildings to be very warm at night. We weren't so much pushing for desaturation in the nighttime look, but definitely during the daytime look. And again, it was to varying degrees. And these are settings that we set up in the camera ahead of photography. And then we work out with our final colorist, how far to go and what each look really means. And then the dailies timers know the correlation between when we put a certain look in the camera with a color temperature and how it should appear. And they keep us matching throughout dailies. So many of the things that you see on screen are very close to what dailies look like, but perhaps just a little bit adjusted, a little bit shaped more, a little bit more consistent than what you would have seen out of dailies from the shooting day.
So prior to filming, you worked with your colors to create custom LUTs you used on set.
Mm-hmm.
And what cameras were you shooting on?
It's always Alexa. It's always the Aeroflex Alexa, a mix between the SXT camera and the Mini.
Now, always just as that's just your go-to or for this series or?
Both.
Really?
I've had years and years and years now of experience with Aeroflex Alexa cameras. I think that they're the closest I can get to working with film. They're the most intuitive for people who started on film, and they deliver an image that is, for my eye, as close to the aesthetic I enjoy as it can be. I've tried every other one, and I keep coming back and say that, you know, for me, if I pull an Alexa out and I have the right LUT in it, and I have the right color temperature in it, and I know my exposure, I will get back an image that is pleasing to the eye, yet at the same time can have all these overtones. I can work with it in underexposure. I can work with it with a hot daylight background, and I can still pull the mood I want from that camera. I find certain other cameras to be colder, less emotional in a way.
So do you, which Alexas are you using? Are you using the minis?
There's the SXT, which is a slightly larger body, but it has a viewfinder that I like a lot, and it has certain other features that I like. And then the mini. And the mini these days is a workhorse camera. It can be built out for a Steadicam. It can be built out to work from a crane arm. It can be handheld, of course, and it can also become a studio camera. And these changes take very little time, and the camera's an absolute diehard workhorse. I've worked with it in very cold temperatures, very hot temperatures, humidity, dry, everywhere I go. Now it's four continents I've worked with this camera on, and it always performs.
It's amazing how many people say they're shooting on the minis. It blows my mind. It really does. Almost everybody I'm talking to is saying it's Alexa minis. We've got a bunch of people that were doing Netflix shows, that are doing Netflix shows, Reds, were their kind of go-to because there wasn't like an Alexa true 4K option for them
right
at that time.
Yeah.
And occasionally I hear Sony Venice, like I'm hearing that more and more.
Yeah.
Alexa 65, I'm hearing more and more. Although what people seem to have a problem with is having enough of them.
Yes.
It's kind of strange, and everybody just kind of seems to keep going back to those minis. And obviously it's not a compromise. It's a fantastic camera, but it's just interesting to hear what people are using.
It's Aeroflex's most successful camera by far. They couldn't make enough of them at one point, and they were overwhelmed by, I think they believed that it was going to fill a niche for smaller handheld, lightweight, or small capture platform, but instead it became everyone's camera for every purpose, which, it's remarkable. Of course, it helps that they engineered it so well, and that it's pretty diehard. You really have to work hard to mess up that camera.
Do you camera test at all, or do you just go right into it? You do. Okay,
we camera test, Jim. More importantly, we'll look to if I have to have a tiny camera capture, like what used to be done by IMOs or lipstick cameras. Now, you know, sometimes you have to have a really small box that'll just record for one specific situation, or like as a crash camera. But yes, I compare resolutions. I compare whether you want to capture it 2K, 3.2K, which gets bumped up to 4K. Sometimes we will compare to an authentic 4K camera like the Sony Venice. And, you know, in the end, it comes down to a certain feeling, which is, I think, most camera would agree that they get a certain feeling. You can do the numbers and you can say, well, this lens has more resolution than that lens, or this lens has a wider f-stop than that lens. In the end, I think you get a certain feeling out of the frame when you look at a certain lens and you say, that's what I want to get, which partly explains why older lenses have now become a real breakout feature of a lot of shoots. People are using the newest cameras, but they're merging them with glass that's 30 and 40 years old, sometimes 50 years old.
So we've done our camera test. You've decided ultimately on the Alexa SXT and then the Alexa Minis. I want to talk a little bit about your lens choices for Castle Rock, and also filtration, if you do any filters on the front of those lenses.
Well, first of all, for lens choices, last season, as I went through a number of older lens series, because I had this idea that if we're going to show an old haunted town in central Maine, that I should be on older glass, I settled on Cook Pancros from the 1970s. Cook, even 60s, Cook Mark IIs and Mark IIIs that had been rehoused by a company called TLS. And TLS has made a really great business of taking older glass and housing it in a newer lens package that is more friendly to the modern camera and assistant world. So it's got standardized pitch on the gears of the iris and the focus. It's got sturdy mounts. It's got a bigger barrel, so it's just easier to work with the lens in terms of putting on a handheld matte box or fitting it to an existing studio matte box. And the rehousings make it a much different game than trying to use these older lenses used to be. The advantage also is that they've gone through the glass and sort of you know, to as much as possible, determine that the glass is up to a technical specification that's consistent. Yeah. However, some of the glass, I mean, these are sometimes 40-year-old lenses, can get a little yellow. They had radioactive coatings which have decayed over time and created a yellow cast on the existing elements. And the elements are very small. They're not large glass lenses. They're small glass lenses. And, you know, they can be a little finicky. Sometimes the depth kind of runs out, or the markings start to fall off, or maybe one side of the frame is getting sharp and the other not so much. So you have to keep an eye on them. But they lend a lot of character. I'm back to emotion, mood, and character. And that character, I think, helps the audience fall into the story in a subliminal way that isn't too showy. It's not me doing a compound crane move or some very bravura long take. It's simply me giving a texture to the image that is in keeping with the themes of the show and provides, I think, a slight undercurrent of dread or decay, even a feeling of a decaying old town. And I looked again this season. I did extensive testing and I looked at all kinds of lenses, both very expensive lenses and inexpensive lenses and newest lenses and still yet older, stranger lenses. I just settled back on the Cook TLS set, which we're augmenting with Zeiss primes. We're using Zeiss super speeds, which have a really wonderful character. The only issue with super speeds is they can be a little bit user unfriendly because they haven't been rehoused. So they're set up more for the film cameras of the 1980s, and they're not so much set up for the current world of video cameras where we use motors a lot. We have motors for iris, motors for focus, sometimes a zoom motor on, and we... It tends to be a very technologically built out camera system, much more so than when I used to be a focus puller. So, you know, we're using those two lenses primarily. And then I use an old zoom, a Cook zoom from the 1980s that I love. And I bring in a long zoom called the Allura, which is a 45 to 250 long zoom for when I need something that's super telephoto. Although, given the nature of our storytelling, we don't really get into super telephoto lenses very much. We're mostly closer, wider, rather than further away and longer.
And what does that do from a story standpoint, having that different look? Because it's a very different look and very different feel.
When you move with a character, or a character moves in your frame and you're on a wider lens, the scale changes more rapidly. If a character steps from 8 feet away from the lens to 2 feet away from the lens on an 18, the scale of their body and frame changes much more dynamically than if they made the same move on a 50 or a 65. Ah. They would get larger, but the scale of it wouldn't change as much. You also feel a certain three-dimensionality when you're moving on a wide lens. If I put a low wide 21 near the ground or 20 millimeter lens and I start moving the camera, the sense of the ground sliding under the bottom of the lens, the sense of the walls bending around as you move through the space is enhanced. When I do the same type of move on a 50 or a 65 or 75, you really don't notice the change of the perspective in space as much because you've already telephotoed into it a bit. It's a classic horror genre thing to get a low wide lens working rather than a medium height or eye height longer lens, which ordinarily you'd use for close-ups or something like that.
Now compare that, the benefits of the wide-angle lens, compare that to the telephoto. What kind of a mood and feel comes from that, in your opinion?
Telephoto lenses are great for when you're trying to show someone's point of view. So if I'm trying to say, this person's being watched, a telephoto lens outside a house at night staring through a window is fantastic. Yeah. If I'm looking through a telephoto lens through a narrow gap in a doorway towards a lit stairwell or a lit window, that feels very voyeuristic and very much like someone's POV, even if the someone is simply an omniscient narrator trying to, you know, show more interestingly the progress of someone through a space. If I telephoto across a long space, like a space of a field to a group of individuals, the shallowness of the depth of field pulls those people out from their background. So I can have a large group of people, but by selectively focusing on one or two human beings in a crowd, or amidst a work site, or in a large open space that has some people in the background, I'm helping the audience understand who is important here, whose attention, to whose attention we're drawing the frame.
Let's take a quick break and talk about Magnanimous Rentals. You can find them at magrents.com, M-A-G-R-E-N-T-S Rentals.com. They are a production equipment rental house based in Chicago, but they ship everywhere in the country, in the U.S., so don't worry. Now, I want you to go there for two reasons. One, they've got a great inventory, so anything that you're looking for, chances are they will have it. Two, their prices cannot be beat. They cannot be beat. Okay, their regular prices are awesome. That's the first thing. But then on top of that, they have these things called flash discounts. And flash discounts are items that are steeply discounted, steeply, sometimes like 50% off. It's insanity. However, it's only for a limited time. So you have to book your items during the time that the flash discount is active. Now, I'm not talking about just stupid little items on flash discount that aren't that expensive otherwise. No, I'm talking about major items. I got an Alexa mini package on flash discount, and it was stunningly inexpensive. It really was. And it makes a huge difference in my budgets. You know, especially when you guys are working on tight budgets, a little bit here and there, a few $100 of savings, you can put that towards, you know, wardrobe department. You can put it towards maybe another PA. It makes a big difference. So head over to magrents.com every day, see what they have to offer, and check for sure if they have a flash discount. Then you'll know because it's a big, bright, red flashing discount sign right in your face when you go to the site. So you can't miss it. And all orders over $500 ship for free as well. And that's huge. So check it out at magrents.com. There is so much more interview to get to. But before we get there, we want to talk about Hedge. Hedge.video/go-creative-show is where you need to go to get this software that will change your life. Hedge is a backup software for filmmakers like us. It's super fast. You can easily keep track of everything with their transfer logs. You can import multiple sources and send it to multiple destinations all at the same time. So think about that. You're on set, your camera operators, your audio techs, your behind-the-scenes photographers, everybody's giving you media cards. You can put them all into Hedge, send them all out to however many destinations you want. For me, I do two backups always. Set it all up, which is super easy. Click transfer and just wait for it to finish. You know it's being done reliably. You know it's being done as fast as possible, faster than the Finder. And the best thing is you get a notification on your phone if you use the Hedge Connect app when the transfer is done. So you have to try this software. And you get a 20% off discount off the full license when you go to hedge.video/go-creative-show. Stop backing up your media in the Finder. It's not the professional way. You're going to start losing stuff. You don't want that. I don't want that. Your media is your currency. That's your gold. It needs to be treated the right way professionally. And that's what Hedge.video is all about. So go to hedge.video/go-creative-show and try it out for yourself. Can you talk to me about your approach to lighting for Castle Rock?
Well, sometimes I just call it naturalism plus, meaning I want it to feel naturalistic. I don't want my lighting to jump out in front as a stylistic choice. I want it to feel like it's motivated by sources within the house or within the environment as much as possible. At the same time, I want to create a look. I want to create a stylistic graphic look. So often this is more on display at night. We do sometimes night photography that has real stylistic choices in it, hard light, long shadows, shaping a frame with areas of darkness and areas of light, putting a minimum amount of top light on something, usually more backlight, side light, and low, underexposed. In daytime, I'm simply trying to control the daylight so it's not unattractive, but at the same time has some dimensionality. Daylight has the positive of giving you a lot of light to work with without your having to put up instruments or set up bounces or things like that. The negative is it's all over the place. And especially with the very sensitive cameras we work with now, it really needs control. Film used to roll off the shadow on daylight more aggressively and used to create contrast where the human eye maybe wasn't seeing it. Now we create that contrast in daylight sets by putting up large negative fills, big black cloths, sometimes 12 feet by 20 or 12 by 12, or if we're on a close-up, we might just put 2 4x floppy flags next to the character outside the frame, and we try and bring in a dark side to something, especially a show that's about, you know, darker subjects. Then conversely, we wrap daylight. So if a large daylight source from above is creating hard shadows on a character, quite often I'll be putting either passive bounce card below the lens to try and wrap that light around, or I'll create a new light source with an HMI light and soft fill the area so that it's not unpleasing. And I'm always cognizant of the fact that I still want it to have a naturalistic feel. I just don't want my character to appear harshly lit or unnecessarily dire.
Can you point to a moment in Castle Rock season one, which is basically all we've seen at this point when I'm interviewing you, that was particularly challenging or rewarding or something that you really want to bring to the viewer's attention?
Well, a lot of the stuff we did at Shawshank Prison was a merging of an actual prison in West Virginia. It was called Moundsville Penitentiary, which is a disused federal prison in Moundsville, West Virginia, and stage sets. And on top of that, the warden's office was at the old state hospital in Tewksbury, Massachusetts.
Oh, really?
It was part of a building where they now have a museum to public health. So we took over a large pair of rooms there and we turned it into Warden Lacey's office, now inhabited by the new warden. Well, I'm sorry. Dead Warden Lacey and then the new warden. But the point is, I was nervous when it came to merging these locations. They're not even in the same state, and some of it's a built set. But looking back on the season, I think it was very successful, to the point where there are scenes where we walk Bill Sarsgaard or other people through a long prison corridor, lit principally by natural light, by the way, you know, tall banks of windows opposite the cells. And we go into a real cell. We chose a cell that was appropriate for filming, and we put a bare tungsten bulb in it, and that was it. You know, we barely augmented it from that.
Wow.
And then we recreated that same prison cell. Steve Arnold created a version of that same prison cell with a bit of a return to look at on our stage.
Was Steve your production designer?
Production designer, okay. Steve Arnold, wonderful guy. And the effect is seamless, and you don't think about it. You don't think you're going from an actual prison in Moundsville into a set where supposedly we're opening a hatch down into an oil tank, and then you're down in the oil tank, which is, of course, a set, and then you're back up in the infirmary with the prisoner, which is a set, and then you're in a cell again with the prisoner, and you can't tell whether it's the cell that we shot on location in a real spot with real daylight or daylight we've created on a stage. And to me, that was a testament to the brilliance of our crew, the consistency of approach, the appreciation of the directors for like making sure that every detail was covered, so that this seamlessness of what really is a big cell. We're selling a big thing, an entire prison, indoor and out. And I thought it was quite well done.
It's seamless from a viewer perspective. My God, I mean, you always know that people. Go ahead.
No, similarly, the Deaver House. In episode one, the Deaver House is almost entirely shot on location, a real house in Orange, Massachusetts, a real home, real furniture, real walls, real windows, real outdoors, real porch, all of it. Steve and his crew based a set off of that exact house, measured it to the inch, and recreated essentially the entire first floor as a stage set, surrounded it by backdrops, you know, photorealistic backdrops, of that moment, like sure, taken at the right time. And then we had to sometimes in the same show see the interior of the real house and then the interior of the set within a sequence.
Wow.
And you never see it. I mean, you've watched it. You tell me if you can tell which is the set.
I never would have thought that. I would have thought it was either entirely a set or entirely a house. That is shocking to me.
Well, obviously, when we look out the front door and you see a realistic background out there with depth and with cars in the background and everything like that,
sure,
that's the real house. We could not have done that on stage. But I will tell you, and I'm not going to tell you where, there are sequences where we look right at that door and right at the false background and the greens that we've placed and the drop.
Wow.
And it is not. You're on stage. And it's not just that verisimilitude that impresses me. The mood was consistent. The tone of photography and the tone of coverage and the tone of what the scenes mean in the narrative and how they help the audience along to understand more and more about Henry, about his son Wendell, about his mother Ruth, about Sheriff Pangborn. All of this happened in a way that was forward-thinking for the narrative instead of backward-thinking for, like, well, how do we technically merge these two locations? So I'm very happy about those examples.
Is there anything you can tell us about what we can expect from season two? Visually?
Okay.
Yeah, like, you can't give any spoilers, obviously, but, I mean, you did mention it's a completely different story, completely different characters. Are we going to be seeing something different? Will there be some visual changes?
There are some visual changes because we're far more wed to the story of one particular character. I won't tell you who that character is, but it's one of the most famous characters in King's bibliography.
Oh, nice.
And following that character closely with the camera, staying within feet of her and closely aligned to her perspective on things, whether her perspective is crazy or sane, is part of the visual architecture of season two. It is a very exciting season, and it has got some mind-blowing stuff in it.
I mean, you've got a fantastic portfolio, obviously. You've done tons and tons of TV work. You're working on Jack Ryan. I mean, that's an action show. It's like the breadth of what you have going on here is pretty incredible. I'm not as familiar with that, so I didn't want to dive too far into it, but is there something that you can tell us about Jack Ryan in just shooting adventure sequences, action sequences that, you know, maybe would be valuable to the audience? Is there some lesson that you learned there?
Well, to begin, rather than thinking of myself as creating tons and tons of television, I like to think of it as bushel and bushel of very delicious entertainment.
Oh, absolutely.
I like to think of myself as the visual farmer out there weeding out the things I don't want you to see and bringing to full fruition every bit of nutritious and good, wholesome entertainment that you can have. But on a more serious note,
I do like that description of it.
No,
that's for sure.
I prefer to create a bushel than a ton. A ton is like I'm dumping stones in your driveway.
Understood.
And they are different shows. And part of the reason I enjoy this profession and part of the reason I was drawn to it and part of the reason that ever since I did my first full season of television, I've been constantly enthusiastic about signing on to long seasons of television, is that you get to slowly, over time, unearth an entire approach to a subject. And we did this in The Americans. We did this in Manhattan. We did my season of Boss was similar. I feel like you get to, over a longer stretch of time, with more interaction with the actors, with more detailed discussions with production designers, and with more experience of a location, tell a story that is closer to a true novel scale than a short story scale.
Yeah.
And you, on top of that, become more intrinsic in the storytelling because, unlike the directors or the editors, you are there every single day and you are intrinsic to decision-making on the fly. No one communicates with you from afar and says, do you want to do this? Although they may do that in prep. It faces you every morning, noon, and night. And in that interactive decision-making, I feel bizarrely, because TV is notoriously a very tough medium for schedule, I feel a freedom that I have not felt on other types of projects. And I try to bring the open mind that I learned making documentaries or doing art world pieces. I try to bring that same open mind frame to narrative storytelling over this long stretch. I will say that Jack Ryan came about because of a director friend of mine who was going up to Montreal to start Jack Ryan season one, and he wanted me to be part of it. And I had never done a fully international show, and this show was going to shoot in Montreal, Paris, Morocco, DC. Where else did we go? I think that might have been it for season one. Season two went more locations. And I happen to speak French. So this to me was like, great, I'll be able to use a language that I don't often get to use. I'll work with foreign crews. I'll learn what it's like to prep internationally, meaning flying to entire other continents to get things ready, then flying back to the continent you're shooting on. And I'll work in a genre that I haven't really approached very much. And to my wonderful surprise, I fell into the work rather, I don't want to say easily, I was ready for the work. I was ready for the work, and if I must say, the work was ready for me. I think our pilot of Jack Ryan is one of the best things I've ever worked on. It's well-conceived, well-written, well-acted, well-directed, beautifully production-designed. But more interesting to me when people saw it It was one of the most accessible pieces of entertainment I've ever worked on. More people got in touch with me to say that they'd seen that than anything else I had done. And this is after three seasons of The Americans, a well-respected show, yeah, which many of my friends saw. Jack Ryan has the crown for most watched and most commended work I've done. Am I always going to want to do a very straightforward character action dramas in which, oh yes, the American guy is always the winner and, you know, foreign nationals are to be distrusted and or pitied? No, those are oversimplifications of life. And I think Jack Ryan, to its credit, actually took on that idea and made some of the quote-unquote terrorist characters more deeply interesting in their lives and in their struggles than others. But what I do like about it is it works on an enormous scale and it works authentically. If we're supposed to see a helicopter, it's really a helicopter. If we're supposed to drive across a vast expanse of desert, it's really a vast expanse of desert. While we can't go to every country we portray, we do travel internationally and we do try to give the audience a picture of life in those locations. And I think that that it's important at this point in time for a U.S. audience to have a picture of life in different parts of the world that do not fully resemble our own, yet you learn, have our same struggles and have our same interest in humanity.
Are listening to the PremiumBeat.com Song of the Week. This one's called Rhythm Roulette by Reactor Productions. Premium Beat is where to go for all of your royalty-free music and sound effects. If you head over to PremiumBeat.com, you get access to a collection of thousands of royalty-free tracks for as low as $49 each. And it's not just the individual track. You get cutdowns, loop sets, stems, everything you need to make the song that you love fit your project perfectly. But it's all about quality, and that's what you're going to find at premiumbeat.com. I head there for every single project. That is no lie. No lie at all. I go to premiumbeat.com and search for music for every project that I have. And most of the time, I find exactly what I'm looking for, that I love, my clients love, and fits the project perfectly. So I know you will too. premiumbeat.com. And lastly, let's talk about Rule Boston Camera. Rule is the place to go to purchase and rent all of your production equipment. They have an amazing inventory, absolutely stunning. I mean, they've been in business for over 35 years, and all the Hollywood features that come through Boston use Rule. So you can imagine, if it's good enough for them, it's good enough for us. But even aside from all of that, what's so great about Rule is their support. Okay, when you go into Rule, you have a partner in your production. They give you expert advice and counsel in pre-production. They give you technical guidance when you take the equipment out for your shoot, and they are committed to support you the entire time your project is going on. So we're talking about peace of mind, world-class inventory, incredible service. It's all there at Rule Boston Camera. And you can get there by going to rule.com, R-U-L-E.com. Production is mission critical, and Rule's got your back. It's time to choose a production partner over at rule.com, R-U-L-E.com. Okay, there is still so much more interview to go to, so let's get right to it. The conclusion of our talk with Richard Rutkowski. I want to switch gears and talk for a few minutes about The Americans, a series I did watch and absolutely loved from start to finish. How many seasons of that show were you involved in?
I shot the first three seasons.
Okay. So were you did the tooth episode?
I sure did.
All right. So I have to talk to you about this. And I'm sure I'm not the only one because
That was directed by Tommy Schlamme, who I also worked with on the show Manhattan. So any commendation and or discomfort with the tooth scene, I want to share fully with Tommy Schlamme because he and I were absolutely on the same page that this is a sex scene in which he's actually extracting her tooth. And it's also one of the most intimate scenes of the series between these two characters who we've watched struggle with their issues of trust and intimacy.
I'm so psyched that you said that, because that's when I was watching this, I'm like, I was watching with my husband. I'm like, this is a sex scene. He's like, what are you talking about? I'm like, it is a sex scene. Because also as the series goes, they kind of grow apart a little bit and their intimacy just isn't as strong. But, I'm so interested that you brought that up. All right. So just to get people up to speed, you don't need to know much. If you're not familiar with the Americans, it doesn't really matter, but it's a husband and wife. They're Russian spies. They're pretending to be Americans. And, one of them, the husband has to pull a tooth out, no Novocaine, no nothing, in the basement of their house. He has to pull his wife's tooth out, two of them. It's a really gross scene, but it's actually
one tooth.
It's only parts of it, right?
Yeah. The reason she can't see a dentist is because they're under intense surveillance by the FBI. There's a huge dragnet out across the city for them, and they have good descriptions of them. And she has been nursing a bad tooth for some time, and a fight she has and a near capture by the FBI, including Agent Gadd, harms and dislodges the tooth and makes it have an infection. She has to get away under extreme circumstances. She has to get away from the FBI dragnet. When she finally returns home, her husband Philip is so distraught. He thought perhaps she'd been captured. Trying to think, they have a very moving, silent scene.
Well, they try to
kiss, and she can't kiss him because of the damn tooth. And so now he's resolved, and of course they're masters of expediency, that the tooth has to come out. And in the attempt, he manages to only get part of it. And she looks at him like, really? And he's like, yes. And they go back in again. And it's a fabulous scene. And it's mostly silent. The characters have very little dialogue, if any.
Well, that's what I wanted to talk to you about, is how did you approach that scene with no dialogue? Because it's one of the most compelling scenes of the series, certainly that season. And nothing is said. It's all eyes. It's all, body language. And it was just so well done. And I'd love to know your approach to shooting a scene that intense without any dialogue.
Well, I like silent scenes. Silent cinema is some of my favorite cinema. And I believe, honestly, that the gift that the actor gives to the camera is communication that's nonverbal. Even when they're speaking, I'm often cueing off of things I'm watching the actor's body language or facial language do, because I believe that that's the story I need to tell. You and I are having a conversation, and we are wrapped up in each other's verbal communication. Yet, somewhere in the back of your head, you're picturing me, and somewhere in the back of my head, I'm picturing you. Mm. It's how we function as human beings, and it's part of our success, is that we have visual imaginations, and that we have a facility for communication that is unparalleled in the world of creatures. So I fully believe that you can have a silent scene where an audience thinks they hear the thoughts expressed of the characters, just like you can have a verbal scene in which the audience subliminally understands dynamics between characters, or a character in the wilderness, or a character in an animal, through what they're seeing rather than what they're hearing. These things, I believe, operate on coincident tracks, and they can diverge and come back together. But I don't need to illustrate the verbal, nor does the verbal necessarily tell me what I need to put on screen. It can be out of sync, in sync, divergent. Sometimes it's more powerful when it's divergent. You hear a raging sermon from a preacher about hell and brimstone, and then you cut to a beautiful lake in the most gorgeous daylight, and you realize the world is not all hell and brimstone. But I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit. In that scene, quite frankly, we knew that the goal was to have an excruciating but increasingly intense intimacy between these characters, that that there would be him straddling her to get the tooth out, and that the camera would be handheld and as close as physically possible to the characters. Mm. The actors, who are wonderful, Matt and Carrie, I cannot say enough good things about working with those artists, were ever accommodating, to where the camera had to be literally sometimes pressed up against one another's or one of their shoulders to get the angles. So I would offer it was a threesome, but I'll stop at that. There was another time in the series, I think it was in season two, where we had a pool murder. We had to have Kerry Russell stab a character with a syringe while in a swimming pool to kill him and make it look like a drowning. In the most close and intense work of that scene, and I was operating the camera in a splash bag myself, I was down in the pool in swim trunks, Kerry Russell wrapped her legs. She's a brilliant dancer and a genius, physical actress. She wrapped her legs around my torso to keep me from losing my place where the lens had to be. So Literally, you've got two characters struggling. One of the characters is this brilliant actress who's wrapping her legs to keep you in position so that you can get the work done. It's what other creative medium offers this? While I love opera, while I love ballet, while I love watching modern dance, while I love going to the theater, very rarely is the lighting designer or the stage manager having to literally cohabit space to get the work done.
Well, you truly are an artist through and through, and an art appreciator. And actually, when you go to your website, c-no-evil.net, one of your sections here, you've got features, TV, stills, then you also have art and doc. Certainly people tout and show their documentary work on their websites, but you really show upfront and personal your artwork. And I wanted to take our last few minutes here and talk about that, because you've done some pretty incredible work with Robert Wilson in a series of video portraits.
Many years ago, when I was 18 years old, I met Robert Wilson somewhat by chance. I was cast in a performance at the American Repertory Theater called The Civil Wars. And I had this sort of, chorus part. I was a small part in it. But he was certainly fascinating. And he asked one night in rehearsal if anyone could build an architectural model. And I was studying architecture at the time, and I was interested in it. So I said, of course. And then he really needed an assistant full time when he was in Cambridge. He was away from his base in New York. And then, we worked together really well. And then I wound up working for him for several summers and making films with him and doing video projects with him. He conceived of the video portraits and started to execute these. Geez, it's a long time ago now. I'm not actually able to tell you a date, but it was in the 1990s. Mm. And I started shooting them with some of the first ones. Mikhail Baryshnikov, Brad Pitt, Peter Stamari.
You have a Steve Buscemi one here.
Right, Steve Buscemi. We did that out in Watermill.
Johnny Depp.
Ryder.
Yeah.
I did not shoot the Johnny Depp one. The one I'm ever so happy about is the Winona Ryder one, which features long changing cues of light to portray the passing of a day. And it's modeled after Samuel Beckett's Happy Days. Happy Days is a play in which a woman is stuck up to her neck in a pile of earth all the way through the play. She can barely move. And we emulated that with Winona Ryder. But,
it is
lots
awesome.
Lots of big name actors, but we would also shoot a sheepdog, or we'd shoot an animal, or we'd shoot a farmer. So it wasn't all celebrities. But those have become a major series of art installations throughout the world. He was assisted in this by his producer, Noah Koshbin. And Noah, who is also Bob's art archivist and helps Bob create his art archive and art collection, is brilliant as well. And, singularly put this work together across the globe. So, it's been an interesting development of all that work. I worked on some of the initial ones, but as I got busier and busier, I simply wasn't available, and he'd have other cameramen and other lighting people come in and execute them. Mm-hmm. And Bob is nothing if not hardworking and nothing if not inspired and nothing if not a genius. So he continually came up with brilliant approaches to this medium. One of the simplest things, which again, you know, sometimes it's a simple decision that makes the most difference, is he had the idea to take the HD screen, which is wider. That was the whole creation of HD, was to say, now you can do a wider landscape shot on your television. And he just turned it vertical to make a portrait gallery, a classical portrait gallery, because portraits frame the body in a vertical fashion rather than a horizontal fashion like a landscape would be. Mm. So it truly was creating a gallery of portraits. And in any case, I enjoyed doing that work. I also made a film with Bob about a woman named Suzushi Hanayagi. Mm. And I will see if I can't send you a link to viewing that. It's a wonderful film. It's a feature-length documentary called The Space in Back of You. And it sort of documents Suzushi's influence not only on Bob, but on a whole set of the avant-garde in the 1980s and 90s, and her own brilliance and her legacy in dance, both in Japan and the United States.
Yeah, you've got two clips of it on your site for people that want to check it out, c-no-evil.net. And it's really interesting stuff. And I think what I like the most about it is, first of all, what I love about your site is you're faced immediately with your stills and you put your artwork really front and center. And I just think your support of that type of filmmaking and that type of photography is really important, because it's always interesting to me. People kind of, I think you see a lot of people start in these smaller art films, you know, in school and maybe shortly after, and then eventually begin their careers and almost push that stuff aside. And I love that you're proud of it and you're putting it out there. And I can tell because of that, that you're a big supporter of doing that type of work. So I want to know why you think that's important for cinematographers to do throughout their career.
Well, you know, my father was a painter. He was a oil on canvas artist, painted landscapes, some portraiture, still lifes. And a lot of my knowledge base for how to deal with the visual comes through art, design, architecture. I try not to make my reference point solely another film, another TV show, and certainly not only contemporary work. I often look backwards to look forwards. So if you want me to describe some of the most scary things I've seen in film, I'll bring up Meshes of the Afternoon, a film by Maya Deren, you know, which has simple effects created on a Bolex and is utterly terrifying. And I think as brilliant as it gets. You know, there's so many examples when you go back in time, you know, Cat People, Val Lewton, where without an enormous technological advantage and without cell phones, you know, people created enormously impactful work that still works on me today. I think what you're asking is maybe why is art so centered up on my site? Well, the site offers.
I'm asking that, but I think it's because of that. It seems like you would encourage cinematographers to do this type of work, to sort of, you know, throw it into their professional career, you know, certainly as they start in working on smaller projects, but even when they're doing more established work. Do you feel like that's an important thing to continue doing these kind of more avant-garde, kind of strange art pieces?
It certainly is important to me. And I think it should be important to most cinematographers to see things differently and to work the medium towards different ends. We spend a lot of time shooting portraiture for television, and we forget that the landscape, the still life, the unexpected frame, you know, something for out of a film like The Last Laugh with its multiple exposures has equal, if not more, weight at times in how it can affect the human psyche. I believe that you have to be able to look at the visual outside of storyline, outside of narrative continuity, and say, what does this image do? And I think that some of the best films ever made have, at one or another point in their progression of storytelling, an abstraction about them. Certainly Kubrick always does. I feel like Tarkovsky is constantly defying you to tell the difference between what he's showing you, your imagination, and a kind of merged visual narrative that can be expressed as so many different things, yet is pointedly this. You know, Oscar Wilde said, truth in art is that whose contrary is also true. And he used to elucidate that by saying witticisms like, I can resist everything except temptation. And the point is, you have to have the one to experience the other. If I show you an image of a rock, if I show you straight on an image of a rock, and then I show you an image of the ocean, and then I show you an image of just wind, you are going to put it together. You won't necessarily put it together the way I might have intended or the way I would. But we know between us that these are elemental things to show an audience. A mother picking up a child in any context, in a context of a different nation, a different continent, a different time, is elemental. And yet, if you start to do more imaginary or more abstract things with that image, it still is about a mother picking up a child. I think that's very important to hold on to.
All right. Well, our time is up. Thank you so much for being on the show. I absolutely loved Castle Rock. Very excited for season two. Of course, The Americans. Now I have to see Manhattan because now I'm learning more about you and Manhattan looks amazing. So I've got to check that out. So of course, you guys can see everything at c-no-evil.net. And I'll put a link to everything on gocreativeshow.com. Do you have an Instagram?
I don't, but my wife, who's a visual artist working with photography and photography medium as sculpture does, and she's at Betsy_Kenyon. Again, @Betsy, B-E-T-S-Y _Kenyon. Her work is extraordinary.
Huh, all right. We'll give that a shot too. Thank you so much, Richard, for being on Go Creative Show. And we'll have, and I want to see you on set. So we're going to have to make that happen.
I hope so. Thank you for your time.
There he goes, Richard Rutkowski, director of photography for Castle Rock and The Americans and so much more. What a great conversation. He was excellent. I hope you guys liked it and let us know what you think. Follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Go Creative Show. Let us know what you think of the show and if you have any guest suggestions. We always take those very serious and many of our guests came directly from your suggestions, our listeners. I also want to thank Matt Russell, who mixes and masters and makes the show sound so good. You can find him at gainstructure.com and on Twitter at gainstructure. And of course, our producer, Connor Crosby, you can find him at ignitionvisuals.com. But of course, this show would never even happen if it weren't for our fantastic sponsors, Rule Boston Camera, Magnanimous Rentals, Shutterstock, Hedge, and PremiumBeat.com. Without these people, the show wouldn't exist. So please support those that support us, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.